Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, October 4th, 2021, and I'm the host of the show, Cara Santa Maria. And before we dive into this week's episode, as always, I'm going to sound a little like a broken record, and I'm going to thank those of you who continue to make Talk Nerdy possible. Remember, Talk Nerdy is and will always be 100% free to download. And that really is because I rely so much on the support of you, the listening audience. You know, sometimes I sell ads. This week is an example of a week when I couldn't sell any ads. And so your patronage really does carry the show through, especially in such a difficult time, a time in which the TV show I was working on was canceled, a time in which my only income is podcast income, and I'm also trying to support myself through COVID-19 and, of course, a PhD in clinical psych. I think of it as an investment, but there are some days when I forget that because it's been rough. You guys make this all possible, and I thank you so much. All right, so this week's top patrons include Rob Schreck. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. You recently even upped your pledge, and gosh, I don't even know how to thank you. I also want to thank Daniel Lang, Tried and True, Mary Neva, Brian Holden, Christopher Pitts, David J.E. Smith, Dudas Infinitas, June Sapara, Ulrika Hagman, and Robert Christ. Thank you all so, so much. And to the, you know, hundreds or dozens, almost hundreds, others of you who, you know, even at a dollar, it's just incredibly, incredibly beneficial. If you do want to pledge your support, you can visit my website, talknerdy.com, also carasantamaria.com, or you can just go directly to patreon.com/talknerdy. All right, so let's do it. Let's talk nerdy. This is such an important chat. It's such a fascinating chat. I had the opportunity to sit down this week, virtually, of course, with Dr. Natalia Pasternak. Now, she's a biologist. She got her PhD and did her postdoc in microbiology and focused in the field of bacterial genetics. She's at the University of Sao Paulo in Brazil. She is also the former director in Brazil of the International Festival of Science Communication, Pint of Science. She's a columnist for the Brazilian national newspaper, O Globo. She writes for Skeptic magazine, Medscape. She does two weekly radio shows. She also, oh gosh, she has done so much important stuff. So here's something really important that I want to highlight. She is the founder of, or I should say the president. Yeah, she's the president of Question of Science Institute, which is the first Brazilian institute for the promotion of skepticism and rational thinking. And she's currently actually a visiting scholar at Columbia University at the Center for Science and Society. And she'll, of course, explain much more of this. She also did write two books to popularize science, including Science in Our Daily Lives and Against Reality, What Drives Denialism and Its Consequences. This week, though, we focus quite a bit on anti-science and pseudoscience in Brazil, especially within the context of the COVID-19 pandemic. Such an important conversation with just a really, really incredible, incredible researcher and science communicator. So without any further ado, here she is, Dr. Natalia Pasternak. Well, Natalia, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
So you were recommended to me to have on the show by Michael Marshall. And of course, for anybody who doesn't remember, Marsh is the project director of the Good Thinking Society and Skeptic Extraordinaire. He's been on the show before. I highly recommend you look up his episode. But he reached out much earlier in the year, actually, to talk a little bit about the work that you have been doing really in the world of COVID and beyond, and recommended that, you know, being on the show might be really not just informative for the listeners, but well, beyond informative, because we're living in this very trying time right now. So I'm very glad that that you've been able to take the time to sit with us today.
Well, thank you so much. I was very glad by the invitation and to March also for recommending me. I was lucky enough to have him in Brazil before the pandemic in 2019. He was one of the guest speakers for my institute's anniversary. And I run an NGO in Brazil, the first Brazilian NGO actually devoted to the promotion of public policies based on science and not on politics or ideology or anything that we think is great. And Marsh came to talk about his work in homeopathy in the UK with the Good Thinking Society. So I'm glad to be on the show and to actually show to the world that, yes, there are skeptics in Brazil too, and we need them right now mostly.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's been such a roller coaster, and it's been, I think, very difficult for many people to keep up with the rate of change in not just the pandemic, but social unrest. As you said, this sort of link between evidence-based thinking and how it's implemented in public policy across the globe. My show is based here in the United States. I know that you're currently a visiting scholar at Columbia, so you're here in the United States right now. And of course, I have lots of listeners. I'd say the bulk of my listeners are from English-speaking countries, the UK, Australia, Canada, South Africa, but we do have a fair amount of listenership all over the globe. So before we even dive into kind of your background, I was wondering if you could tell me kind of where things are in Brazil right now with regards to kind of social standing, with regards to the pandemic and general public attitudes towards science.
Yeah, Brazil is a mess right now. I mean, Bolsonaro's government is definitely the most anti-science government we ever had in Brazil. And I mean, we had bad governments, just like every other country. And by bad, I mean some were really, really bad. But nothing compares to Bolsonaro when it comes to scientific attitude and democratic attitude as it is. Bolsonaro has been denying science from the start, even before the pandemic. His views towards climate change and environmental policies have always been denying the science for a political agenda. And so this was no surprise, actually, that when the pandemic hit, he would view the pandemic and try to handle the pandemic the same way that he did with every other scientific issue, denying the science. And that's exactly what he did. He has been denying pandemic science from the start. First, he denied the pandemic itself, saying that it was just a minor flu and that it's nothing. We shouldn't worry about it. We should face it like men, not boys. That was his exact words. And then he went on to denying the necessity of preventive measures. So there's no need for mask wearing. What are you, a sissy, going wearing masks on the streets? There's no need for social distancing. Come on, are you going to ruin the economy? People need to get out to work. So he confused the population with these interpretations of reality that are really against any kind of reality. And then he moved on to deny the need of vaccines, so because he didn't want to purchase vaccines. So it was easily justifiable if you deny that vaccines are even needed. Oh, I don't know about these vaccines. They are very new. I think they are going to turn you into an alligator. And then, of course, he denied scientific method itself when he promoted miracle cures in Brazil. He's still talking about the use of hydroxychloroquine. He even mentioned it at his speech at the UN. We have never heard of such a thing, a Brazilian president starting his speech at the United Nations talking about a drug, an unproven drug, by the way, for COVID-19. So this really confuses Brazilian population. And while his support has been decreasing, he still has the support of at least 20-25% of the population. And this is a lot. This is a lot of people who are still confused about vaccination, about the pandemic itself, about mask wearing, and about democracy.
Yeah, and I can imagine that even individuals who don't overtly support Bolsonaro in polling data are still have still implemented some of the normalization of his views simply because they've been reinforced over and over. So unless they're overtly rejecting his views, I'm sure some of that information has worked its way into the consciousness of, you know, millions of Brazilians.
Yeah, probably. And this is it. Well, for instance, we never had a strong anti-vax movement in Brazil. Brazil has always been very favorable to vaccination. The population is used to getting vaccines for free because we have a public healthcare system that caters to over 200 million people and delivers vaccines to over 200 million people. So Brazil is very used to vaccination programs. And it's the first time in Brazil that we see some rising of the anti-vax movement, and I believe it has everything to do with the political moment that we live in and the doubt that Bolsonaro has been broadcasting about vaccines. Are they even necessary? I don't know. They're going to turn you into an alligator. And of course, people don't really believe that, but they start to question, is it really necessary? Shouldn't we wait? Are all these vaccines as good as they say? And these questions, these doubts, they are the seed for the growth of anti-science movements, just like anti-vax movements. And I don't know if maybe in 10 years, 20 years' time, we'll be in the same situation as the US or France, where people have vaccines but just won't get vaccinated.
Yeah, and I mean, that's really sort of lends itself to my next question, which really has to do with the relationship between Bolsonaro and his leadership and Donald Trump and his leadership here in the United States in the last administration. Obviously, the similarities are eerie. I think in many ways, Brazil is dealing with something even more dire than we dealt with in the United States. But how much do you think that Donald Trump really bolstered Bolsonaro and vice versa in this sort of unholy alliance?
We used to call Bolsonaro the tropical Trump. I think that Trump to Bolsonaro, Trump is a hero. He wants to be like Trump when he grows up, and but unfortunately, I think that yes, he is even worse. Because Trump, in all his anti-science statements and in all his denialism, I know that he also was in favor of hydroxychloroquine. And I think Trump and Bolsonaro together, they really, really contributed to the hype of these miracle drugs in the world. But Trump, at least, he was very aware of the importance of vaccination, and so he supported Warp Speed. And this is something that we don't see in Brazil. So I really think that Bolsonaro is even worse than Trump. He can be even worse, not only in his anti-science statements, but in his anti-democratic statements. I think we are in a worse situation, and at least you got rid of yours.
Right. And what do the terms look like in Brazil? Like, how do the term limits work? Do you have term limits? What does the future hold? What's the expectation?
We have term limits, but this is his first term. And we also, we have a joke in Brazil that since he likes to imitate Trump in everything that he does, we hope that he also imitates him in doing only one term. So we really hope he's not going to be reelected. He could, but I think he won't. But the thing is, we still have 1 year to go before re-election or not election, which is, of course, our preferred choice. But I don't know. There's still a lot of the country to be ruined in 1 year. And I think that Bolsonaro shows that he's really capable when it comes to ruining a country. And I don't think we should give him another year.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And so, you know, that obviously leads us to kind of the heart of the question here, which has to do with what your experience has been like and how you have fought back as an individual who, you know, works in not just the public communication of science and skepticism, but you know, molecular biology, genetics. You have a deep understanding, or I'm sorry, microbiology and genetics. You have a deep understanding, of course, of these very important public health issues. And so as you were starting to hear just even the ripplings of pushback against scientific consensus in the early days of the pandemic, I mean, I can imagine that you were, you know, deeply motivated to do anything you could. How did that kind of go for you as the pandemic continued on?
Yeah, it was a lot of hard work ever since, and not that it wasn't hard work before, but before the pandemic, my work was much more of a niche work where science, of course, faced many, many problems in Brazil, from funding. We already had, even before the pandemic, major budget cuts for science funding in Brazil. Brazil relies mainly on public funding for science. So we were already suffering from those budget cuts. And of course, it's not only funding. Science has to be respected to if you want reliable public policies and public policies that work, they should be science-based. And so I was already working, trying to promote these science-based public policies. But when the pandemic hit, the amount of work, the workload just, I don't know, tripled, quadrupled. It was something really, really unheard of before in Brazil. Because as I said, we had never gone through a situation in Brazil where the government itself was the major promoter of anti-scientific beliefs. And this makes it much harder to fight, because one thing is to fight several associations, like, of course, we had our quibbles with the Homeopathic Brazilian Association because we were trying to remove homeopathy from the public healthcare system. But it's very different when misinformation comes directly from the federal government, from the Ministry of Health, when you have to fight against the national institutions of the country. So it's much harder to fight. I think Brazilian media, Brazilian press has been doing a wonderful job, and this has really helped the work of science communicators such as myself. But it's not enough, because even if the whole press and all the science communicators and advocates and scientists and the whole scientific community in Brazil says that this drug, for instance, doesn't work for COVID-19 and we need vaccines, and then comes the Minister of Health and says just the opposite, says that vaccines don't really work, because you see, I am vaccinated and I got COVID, and this is the Minister of Health speaking. And the Ministry of Health as an institution promotes the same miracle drugs that we're fighting against. So it's much harder to fight. And we have been devoting all our resources in my institute for the pandemic ever since it started. It's been tough.
So I'm wondering, what have some of the approaches really been? Because, I mean, ultimately, that's the big question. It's the question I'm often asked when I go on other shows. It's the question I find myself grappling with my colleagues in science communication and skepticism, is how do we get through? And it's not just about improving information, it's about undoing misinformation. And so, you know, what sort of tacks have you taken to be able to try and make an impact when you're really, it's a kind of in many ways a David and Goliath situation? You're fighting against the government, you're fighting against, like you said, the Ministry of Health is promoting pseudoscience. How do you push back against that for the general population, for the health and safety of the citizens?
Yeah, it's not only about information, but I think it's about making information available in a way that people can understand it without the need of a scientific background. And it looks very simple. We say, okay, so it's just about writing newspaper articles about science and explaining the science to the general public. Yeah, that's part of the job, and it's an important part of the job. But information has to be available online for free, and it has to be repeated over and over, because misinformation is repeated over and over. So what I learned, especially during the pandemic, working with science communication, is that repetition is never enough. There's always someone who's hearing that information for the first time. So you have to repeat it, and you have to convey it in an accessible and easy to understand way. So this is one thing. But we know that it's not enough to have information available in a very political environment, because most people won't even read it. Most people, when they see that I wrote a newspaper article, for instance, if they are sided with the government, they're going to say, oh, it's that Dr. Pasternak again. No, she's against the government. I'm not going to even read what she says. So it's not just about making information available, but it's about understanding the political environment that we're dealing with and how science has been polarized and politicized, and that we have to tackle this environment too. Apart from that, so information, politics, and also people's fears. You were talking about my background as a geneticist and a microbiologist. So I think that we can't afford to make the same mistakes as science communicators over and over again. When we were 20 years ago, 30 years ago, when the first genetically modified organisms were coming into the market, we made the terrible mistake, especially the companies made the terrible mistake of thinking that the general public wouldn't be affected by genetically modified organisms, that the only people that need to be convinced and to be persuaded were the producers, and no one talked to the public. And now with the genetic vaccines, we are making the same mistake again. It's not just about approving the vaccines with our regulatory agencies, but we have to talk to the public and we have to explain genetic vaccines, because people are afraid, and they have every right to be afraid if no one took the time to explain it to them. It's weird. Some people look at genetic modification as playing God or going against nature. So it is our job as science communicators to really take the time to explain how the vaccines are made, why we know they're safe, what's genetic modification after all, and we've been doing it for many, many years. So these questions, they are legit. They need clarification. And we need to take the time to clarify these questions to the public.
And how effective do you think that the work that, you know, you and your colleagues have been doing is? Like, are you starting to see any change? I mean, it actually sounded pretty promising when you told me at the beginning of the show that Bolsonaro really only holds support of about 25% of the population. I think, you know, even when Trump was leaving office, his support was higher than that.
Yeah, I think it's a win. Bolsonaro is losing popularity. And I think one of the reasons that he's losing popularity is this joint effort by journalists and science communicators. The whole Brazilian press is doing a terrific job. So it's a win. But 25% of the population still scares me, because it's still a lot of people that, although it's really clear what he's done to the country, people still support him. But anyway, I think it's a win. And it's not only about Bolsonaro, but about Brazilians being willing to get vaccinated and being pressuring the government for more vaccines. So I think this is also a win for us, although I don't think it's just the merit of science communication, because as I said, Brazilians are very used to vaccination programs. So I think it's the merit of 30 years of a very good vaccination program before Bolsonaro really tried to ruin it. But anyway, I think we have been successful in some ways. I think the most successful event for myself, at least, was when I was invited to speak at the Senate during our Parliamentary Commission of Inquiry that's going on by now, to investigate the president's responsibility for the pandemic. And so I was called, and I was called to the Senate as a science communicator, as the president of an NGO that promotes science-based public policies. And this was unique for me because we had never heard of a scientist or science communicator being called to the Senate to depose and to talk about the president's responsibility in handling science communication during the pandemic. So I was called as a science communication expert. And this was huge because this was one of my goals when I started the Institute Question of Science, my NGO, in 2018. So in less than 3 years, I was already talking to the senators in Brazil about scientific method and about why respecting science will enable them to make better policies. So I think we're in the correct path here in Brazil, but it's very difficult in such a denialist government.
Yeah, it sounds like it. You know, I'm wondering, sometimes when I think, you know, in parallel about the mentality here in the U.S., I worry that Trump was really, yes, he was a leader, really a global leader that, I mean, I'm using leader very loosely in air quotes, but that sort of was able to take a growing movement by the reins and steer it in a direction that was incredibly agenda-driven. But I don't think Trump invented or in any way created the mentality that was already existing sort of on the fringes in the United States. I think what he did is he codified it and he bolstered it. And so I'm wondering, you know, from your perspective in Brazil, is the anti-science movement, the distrust movement, the, you know, kind of quote, post-truth movement, something that was already really, you know, building in the background? Or do you really see this as the kind of brainchild of Bolsonaro? And when he's out of office, do you think that the Brazilian people will have the opportunity to bounce back to a more trusting stance when it comes to scientific authority?
Well, if you come to think of it, more than 50 million people voted for Bolsonaro. So this very conservative environment, anti-science and conservative environment that we live now in Brazil, just like the US, just like England, it was not born in a vacuum. It already existed. That is why these guys got elected, because there were a lot of people who were just confirming their own biases when voting for Trump or voting for Bolsonaro. They wanted these guys because these guys, in a way, represented what they thought was right. All the conservative family values that they thought were being disregarded by the left and could be saved by these messiah-like presidents. I think one of the things that they have in common, Trump and Bolsonaro, is that they are very self-centered. People really look to them and not to their political agenda. They see them as heroes, as saviors, and as saviors of a very conservative religious way of thinking. So this is the environment that they got elected. And here in Brazil, I'm actually in the US, but in Brazil. In Brazil, I think this religious conservative movement had been building in the previous governments and really paved the way for someone like Bolsonaro to be elected. So I hope that people have realized their mistake, and maybe we can get some balance in the next elections. But it's going to be difficult because the opposition in Brazil is really divided and Bolsonaro has no clear opposition. I don't think that he will be reelected, but I don't think that we have a clear opponent that I think that people are just going to vote against him and do anything to stop him from being reelected. But I really have no idea who is going to be the opposition.
And how does it work in Brazil? Is it similar to the US in that if there is split opposition, it actually favors the opposing candidate the incumbent candidate? Or do you have, what's it called, like a ranked order electoral process in which, do you need a true majority in order to win election? Or is it really just whoever has the most votes?
Yeah, we have a direct vote system, so it's not exactly the same as in the US. But what you said before, I think goes that a very divided opposition really usually favors the incompetent opponent. So when opposition is not really organized, people start to vote for various candidates. So we usually have two turns in the elections, two shifts. And so people will probably scatter their votes for various candidates of the opposition. And then two candidates will make to the second turn, to the second shift of the election, probably Bolsonaro and another one. And that's what I said. Then people will vote against Bolsonaro. So whoever wins this first turn among various opponents will become Bolsonaro's opponent in the second turn, and then we'll see, he'll probably win. But as of now, it's very difficult to predict who this opponent will be.
Yeah, and I think we did see something quite similar during Biden's candidacy, that we didn't know if it would go for Bernie Sanders, all of the different Democratic or progressive candidates that were kind of all over the map. We weren't really sure how centralized it would be. And then eventually Biden really did emerge as sort of front runner opponent. And ultimately, of course, everybody who didn't want Trump in office supported Biden. It was, we, in many ways, some of us, yes, were voting for Biden, but many others were voting against Trump. And yeah, I think we'll see, we'll see something similar there in Brazil. And you're hopeful for that?
Yes, I am, because anything is better than Bolsonaro. We can't afford to have Bolsonaro in office for another term. We just can't afford it. Democracy in Brazil can't afford it. Science in Brazil can't afford it. The environment in Brazil can't afford it. Bolsonaro is really wrecking the country in every way possible. So anything is better than him.
And so, where is the sort of general, and it's such a hard thing to, I guess, communicate the quote, general public view as of today. I mean, we're coming on 2 years living with the exhaustion, the social unrest, the psychological distress of such a vast and aggressive change to individual lifestyles. People have lost their jobs. People have been, significantly less social. They've had less social support. They've experienced severe trauma. And when you add all of these kinds of things together, the unrest that comes from the chronicity of this pandemic, It really does lead downstream to a strange and in many ways unpredictable mentality among the citizenry, among the populace. So I'm wondering, where is the general kind of, what is the general vibe within Brazil currently?
Yeah, I think it's difficult to analyze. And of course, I'm not a psychologist, but I think the general vibe regarding, especially towards the pandemics, that, and I think it's the same everywhere in the world, people are tired. people are really tired of all the regulations and the preventive measures and mask wearing, and people are tired of not knowing exactly what the future brings. So they are tired of having no perspective, and this is difficult for science communicators, because science is about uncertainty, and communicating uncertainty, I think, has proven to be a major challenge during the pandemic, and communicating uncertainty is communicating science. So we have to learn to communicate uncertainty in a way that doesn't make people panic, that makes people embrace uncertainty as a building knowledge, that they see uncertainty. Okay, so there are lots of things that we don't know but right now, but we are working on that, and look at all the things that we already discovered, and look at all the things that we already know. So we know that mask wearing is necessary, and it's really useful, and it really prevents infection. So we really know that vaccines are safe and effective, and that any vaccine now should be used, and maybe later we can refine on what we know about vaccines and pick the best ones, but now we really need them all. So there are lots of things that we already know, but it's difficult to communicate uncertainty because people really want certainty. They want someone to come and say, the pandemic is going to end by December 2021, and next year everything will be back to normal, and everyone will be vaccinated, and we will have shipped vaccines to all of developing countries in the world. So it's not going to happen. We can't promise things like that. And so we have to learn as science communicators to communicate how science works and why science is about uncertainty, and we can't give black and white answers, especially when it comes to drugs and vaccines. People sometimes they want it to be black and white. So either vaccines work perfectly, 100% all the time in everyone, or they are useless. And no, it's not how vaccines work. Vaccines work based on probability, and communicating probability and risk, not an easy task. So I think the pandemic has forced us as scientists and science communicators to refine our communication skills so as not to frustrate the population all the time, because people are tired and they want answers. And sometimes the answers are just as good as we can give them. The answers will be uncertain, and we'll have to handle that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's such an important point that you're making. And again, you may not be able to answer this question, quote, scientifically. As you mentioned, you're not a social scientist, but in your experience, kind of anecdotally, in the work that you've done, this idea of difficulty with risk and uncertainty, this idea of sort of the kind of human experience of wanting a very black and white answer, do you think that this is in our nature, or do you think that this is something that we have learned through our world leaders, through a sort of emphasis, especially in the West, on communicating with a sort of no apologies, no gray area, no nuance way, and that we can ultimately unlearn it and become more comfortable operating in the gray and in the unknown?
I think that we can unlearn it. I think it has to do with the way that we are taught science from a very young age. I mean, we don't teach our children to think scientifically. We just give them facts that they have to memorize and they have to believe. You say to a child that the earth is round. You don't explain how we came to this conclusion. You don't explain the experiments that were made before we could reach out to the stars and take a picture of the Earth and prove that it's round. Well, we knew it before. And what were the experiments that were made that that allowed us to come to the conclusion that the Earth was round. So we should be teaching our children how science is made, how science comes to conclusions, how scientific consensus are born, and not just giving them facts to memorize. And the way that we teach science, we teach it as a bunch of facts, and then we test our children with right or wrong answers in quizzes. This is how we test children. So if we don't want people to think in black and white situations, maybe we shouldn't teach them to from a very young age. Because this is the way that we have been teaching science. We haven't been teaching scientific thinking. We haven't been teaching rational thinking or critical thinking. So it's no wonder that when we grow up, we want black and white answers, because that's the way we were taught. And I think, yes, we can unlearn it if we start teaching science as a way of thinking, as a process, and not as a bunch of facts to memorize.
Absolutely. I completely agree. It is a very, very tall order. I'm so hopeful and appreciative that you have, in many respects, really dedicated your career to doing this, and that there are individuals all over the globe who are dedicating their careers to doing this within, I think, the context of their culture, because that's such an important discussion point that I want to take on with you, which is, how important do you think it is? And obviously, that's a leading question, because it's incredibly important that that individuals who have their boots on the ground, who understand the religious, the cultural, the spiritual, the historical components of their nationality, of their mentality, be the ones who are communicating these topics to their own people. I think we often, especially in the West, have a bit of a white savior complex, where we feel that we can go into other nations without any context and without any understanding of, you know, historical oppression or of social unrest or any of these issues, and from on high say, you shall believe what I teach you, you know, which is it's just a recipe for disaster. And so maybe we could speak a little bit, and you could tell me a little bit about your thoughts with regard to individuals, you know, promoting science and skepticism from within their own communities.
I think it's essential to work with community leaders, religious leaders, to talk about science, to bring science into their communities, and respecting their traditional values, their traditional thoughts. And I think we have to be very clear that respecting someone's values and respecting someone's traditional knowledge is a must. And of course, we have to respect but it's not the same as turning it into a public policy. For instance, here in Brazil, we have in our healthcare system, as I told you, we have a public healthcare system. And in this healthcare system, we have 29 alternative medicine modalities. 29. This includes the most popular ones like homeopathy and acupuncture, which are not, of course, traditional Brazilian knowledge, but they are included in these practices. But there are 29 of them. So there is homeopathy, acupuncture, and there are some things like family constellations and circular dancing and a hand in position. And these things are not traditional values, but they are sold as traditional values. So when you speak again, homeopathy or acupuncture, people here in Brazil sometimes accuse you of being against traditional indigenous values in Brazil, where it's nothing of the sort. Homeopathy was invented in Germany, for instance, and it's not traditional, it's not millenary at all, it's just 200 years old. So people get very confused about respecting traditional values and turning anything that could be portrayed as a traditional value into a public policy, especially a health policy, because that's very dangerous. And that being said, I think that working with traditional leaders, community leaders, and religious leaders is, of course, essential to bring science, to bring vaccines, for instance, to their communities. I saw a video early in the vaccination program here in Brazil, and I think it was one of the most beautiful videos I ever saw in a vaccination program, because it was an indigenous leader receiving a box or a nice box of vaccines, and he did a blessing for the vaccines before he took it to his community. So they danced around in an indigenous blessing of the vaccines. They chanted and danced around this box filled with vaccine doses. And this was a blessing for the vaccine, saying that the vaccines were very welcome in their community. So this is how you do it. And I think that this really works. And it was just beautiful.
I love that. And, you know, I think it also, it shows that there's a certain amount of, again, sort of Western white savior-oriented mentality around distrust of medicine that is incredibly dismissive of the complexities of traditional practices and indigenous culture. One of the things that I often hear from well-meaning colleagues has to do with vaccination programs across the continent of Africa. And, you know, I'll hear people who love to cite statistics or who love to talk about, you know, distrust of Western medicine, distrust, as you saw during Ebola epidemics, distrust, you know, due to obviously very egregious practices coming from the West. But they will almost cite those things as if to explain away why vaccination rates are low, instead of really grappling with the idea that vaccines aren't available to these communities. And, it, you know, kind of like that's all good and fine to talk about vaccine hesitancy among a community that already has access, but that's not even the issue we're dealing with right now.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And as I said, people confused scientific evidence with traditional knowledge. When I opened the Institute in 2018, my keynote speaker was Professor Edzard Ernst from the UK. And he said something that I never forget, because it's a beautiful way to describe it. And he said that the best way to honor traditional knowledge is to test it, to run it through scientific method and to validate it. And this is what we should do. So this is how we honor this traditional knowledge. And we should not, of course, turn our noses against it and say, oh, I'm not going to even look at that. No, we have to look into that, but we have to run it through science to validate it. And if it's not valid, then we have to talk to these communities and say, okay, so you have this traditional knowledge, which is all right, and I understand that it has been in your community for generations, but here, these vaccines, these medications can also help your community because this is how they work. So you have to establish a conversation, and you are not going to bring this, even if it is traditional knowledge, into a public policy service, into a health policy service, if it's not scientific and if it's not proven to work. So you have to draw a line there. And this line is not disrespectful. This line should be inclusive.
Yeah, I agree. I absolutely agree. And of course, this is something that you and your institute have grappled with in Brazil, because you do have that sort of marriage of traditional indigenous views and sort of the broader scientifically informed views. And then, of course, the active anti-scientific views that are, as we mentioned before, being promoted by individuals within positions of governmental power. And what a difficult balancing act to constantly have to grapple with, to constantly have to perform.
It is. When I spoke at the Senate, I ended my speech saying that denialism kills people. So we can't allow denialists in positions of power because they are going to kill people. And this is what we're seeing in Brazil right now.
Yeah. And how do you think that, you know, if it were up to you, kind of if you really had all of the reins and all of the control, do you think, I mean, I'm often saying lately that I would like to see individuals prosecuted for their crimes. I would like to see the most egregious perpetrators of misinformation that I believe directly leads, as you mentioned, to loss of life and loss of livelihood. Being held accountable, is that something that you would like to see enforced?
I think I would love to see it enforced, but I don't think that I will in Brazil. We have a saying in Brazil. I don't know if Americans can understand it, but we say that everything in Brazil ends up in pizza. It's a way of saying that it's nothing's going to happen. People are just going to forget it and just brush it under the carpet and be done with it. And this is what usually happens in Brazil. But I don't know, maybe this time we have this parliamentary committee going on investigating the government. They are probably going to issue their report in a couple of weeks. And this report could lead to an impeachment and a criminal investigation of the responsibility of the president himself. But we know that it's not only the president. There are lots of other perpetrators of misinformation here in Brazil that need to be punished. And we know how difficult it is to punish people in power. So let's wait for the best, but I'm not very hopeful.
I agree. And I think that leads me then to sort of the close of the show where I ask my final two questions, which are sort of big picture questions. But before we dive into that, because I do think they're related sort of to what we were just saying, I'm wondering if there's anything that we, you know, haven't covered in this hour, a little less than an hour that we've spent with each other today, anything that you want to make sure is heard by an audience, especially a predominantly American or English-speaking audience about any of the topics that we've talked about today?
Wow, I don't know. I think we covered so much.
Right? Yeah, I agree. I just always want to make sure because I would feel terrible if there was something I should have asked, which I didn't ask. So
I'll probably think of that in about a week. And
exactly.
Then I'll think,
oh, I should have said that. Gosh, I know the feeling. Well, then on that note, that leads me, as I mentioned, to these final two questions. So I always close the show the same way. I ask my guests two pretty big, you know, picture questions, and I'm looking for really authentic answers, and they could be in whatever context is relevant to you. They could have to do more with you personally. They could have to do with kind of a larger social context, maybe something even global or cosmic, whatever is relevant to you right now. So I'm wondering, number one, what is the thing that really is keeping you up the most at night, the thing you're most concerned about, perhaps even bordering on pessimism or cynicism? And then on the flip side of that, so we end on a more positive note, what are you genuinely optimistic about? What are you looking forward to and hopeful for?
Okay, so what keeps me up at night, being Brazilian right now is really difficult. I mean, look at what we've been through in the United Nations thing, the president talking about a miracle drug, the minister of health showing his finger to people who are protesting on the street and coming up with COVID and then using his coming up with COVID to discredit vaccines. So it's really difficult to be Brazilian right now. And I think what keeps me up at night is thinking, will Brazil really recover from this government? Will Brazilian science really recover from this government? I mean, Brazilian science has been so destroyed in the present government, and not that it wasn't suffering before. As I said, we had already been suffering from major budget cuts in science in Brazil, even in the previous governments, but Bolsonaro really wrecked scientific funding and science itself in Brazil. And I think it can take decades for a country to recover from these cuts. I mean, we have no scholarships for our students. We have no grants for our laboratories. How are we going to recover from this? We are suffering from a major brain drain. Everyone's leaving Brazil if they get a chance, and I can't blame them. I mean, I'm in the US as well, and here it is much easier for me to work. So I don't think we will really recover from Bolsonaro quickly. I think it'll take decades, and this really keeps me up at night. It's really difficult to think of the future in my country and what it can bring. And to be optimistic, on another way, I don't think that science communication has ever been this valued in the world, not only in Brazil, but in the world. And if I examine my situation individually, I have been working with science communication for years, but during the pandemic, I've been called to speak at the Senate. I've been invited to host two radio shows about science. I've been invited to write a weekly column for Brazil's largest newspaper. So I have been given opportunities during the pandemic that people maybe realized how important, how essential science communication is to science itself, to the development of science in a country. And I don't think this is this happened just in Brazil. I think it's global. It's a global perspective of how science communication is essential during a health crisis, for instance. And suddenly people realize that working with science communication is an important and an actual job, because a few years ago, science communication was seen as a hobby, as a part-time job, as a secondary thing. And I think so this makes me really optimistic. So maybe now people will look to science communicators as a career path, and as a very important career path. So maybe now having a background in science can become an important background for people who go in communication or even into politics. I mean, we have usually people who go into politics or policy making come from law schools or public administration schools or economic schools. Why not science? Science is as important a background as any if you're going into policymaking or politics. We should have more scientists in the Congress and representing people and advising governments. So maybe this is a scenario that we will see in the future. I have been working with science diplomacy here at Columbia University, and we took a very preliminary survey that showed that only 12 countries in the world have an actual office called a scientific advisor or a chief scientific advisor to the president or to the government. 12 countries. And it's a very preliminary survey. Of course, we looked for this very specific office, but it tells us something. And maybe this scenario will change. Maybe it's time that we realize that governments need scientific advisors. And if they need these people with this kind of training, well, someone has to train these people to become scientific advisors. So maybe we're looking into a new scenario where we will have more job opportunities for scientists, which is good because we cannot fit everyone inside the academia. There is not enough room for all the grad students that finish their PhDs. And most of them might look to, might be interested in a different career path. So this makes me optimistic. I think times are changing for science communication and advocacy.
I absolutely agree. It's very validating, I think, to myself as a science communicator. And it's also very hopeful to me as I see, you know, younger people, recent graduates, or individuals who are actively working in academia, sort of picking up that that torch and running with it and choosing sometimes to even leave their degrees or, you know, to finish their degrees or people who never got degrees, which they're all equally valid paths, and really taking that torch and running with it and saying, I'm going to do this. I'm going to do this for a living. I'm going to figure out how to make this my life's work. And I'm going to get paid for it. And I think that that's a really important change.
That's the most challenging part.
Yeah. It is. Oh, it's absolutely the most challenging part. And it's really hopeful for me to see that some people, not everyone, but some people are having a pretty good go of it. And that's really, really hopeful for me as well. So on that note, Natalia, I just want to thank you so much for joining me today, for sharing your insights, and beyond that, for doing the incredibly important work that you do. I wish you the absolute best in your continued efforts, and I hope that you will keep us here on Talk Nerdy informed as you continue on your path.
Thank you, Kara. And right back at you, really, you have been doing amazing work in science communication. I've always been a big fan of the show, so I'm really glad to be here, and I hope I can contribute more in the future.
Well, thank you so much. And everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.